From Springfield, this is State Week, a program of analysis and commentary on the events that made news this past week in Illinois state government and politics.
Getting 70% of our adult population vaccinated is a big milestone, but it's not enough. And we're still, you know, we have second vaccinations that people need to get. We have people who haven't gone yet for a vaccination. If you're hesitant, please learn more. There are plenty of places you can do that. Ask your own doctor. We've now made vaccine available at everybody's physician, their regular physician. So please reach out to them if you have questions and go get vaccinated.
It's Governor J.B. Pritzker pleading with more people in Illinois to get vaccinated for COVID-19. The state is even offering chances to win money and prizes, but will it help as fears over a fast-spreading COVID variant continue to mount? Also, the president made a stop in Illinois. What did he have to say? We'll discuss that and more coming up on State Week. I'm Sean Crawford in Springfield. Our panel includes Charlie Wheeler, emeritus professor and former director of the Public Affairs Reporting Program at the University of Illinois Springfield. Charlie is also a longtime State House reporter and observer. And with us, we have Hannah Meisel, NPR Illinois State House editor. And joining us today, Rachel Hinton. She covers government and politics for the Chicago Sun-Times. Rachel, it's always good to have you back with us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Well, there have been a lot of positives this year regarding the pandemic when we look at the vaccine development and getting that into people's arms, also the reopening of the economy. Yet in recent days, there seems to be this dark cloud on the horizon. Vaccine rates have slowed, what's known as the Delta variant becoming more prevalent. Hannah, you wrote this week that one part of Illinois is seeing a jump in cases, especially, and that's that Metro East area near St. Louis. So tell us as we start, what's going on there?
That's right. Well, Missouri, our neighbor to the west, has the most new COVID cases per capita in the nation right now. And also, you know, a huge spike in their hospitalizations from COVID. And that's driven by the so-called Delta variant. As listeners may remember, the UK variant, when it was, you know, first on the scene in late December, January, that one was dubbed kind of like twice or 50% more transmissible than the original SARS-CoV-2 virus, you know, that fueled COVID in the first place. And the Delta variant is considered about 50% more transmissible than that one. So it's a, you know, it's a virus mutation that is more contagious and appears to be possibly more deadly. So it's worrisome. And so, you know, the parts of Illinois that border Missouri, especially, you know, not just the Metro East, but also Southern Illinois and, you know, the region that Springfield's in, Region 3, especially toward the western part of the state, those three EMS regions are definitely experiencing a lot more case positivity, a pretty big spike in the last couple of weeks. And we remember, you know, I think we might have mentioned on the show last week that the Department of Public Health was reporting a Christian camp in Rushville in Western Illinois, at least 85 cases of an outbreak there in mid-June. You know, most of the attendees, the campers and the counselors at that camp were unvaccinated. So it's really becoming a, you know, a pandemic for the unvaccinated. These variants mutate in unvaccinated people, especially, you know, scientists think that they especially mutate in people with lowered immune systems who can't fight off the virus. And, you know, we are at risk to get a whole new variant that our vaccines can't combat.
Rachel, the Chicago area, we saw, you know, a huge spike in cases last year. Things that were not very good there. What are we seeing right now? Do we know where the numbers stand in the Chicago region?
Case numbers and death counts are better, I believe, this week. You know, the city slash the state reported its first day of zero deaths from COVID. since, you know, the pandemic began. Case numbers and hospitalizations are trending upward again, though, which is causing some concern for, you know, elected officials. But for the most part, you know, we're not seeing, you know, the same problems that the Missouri area, downstate Illinois, is seeing currently. But there are concerns, you know, from elected officials, from public health officials, that the Delta variant is going to, you know, become the predominant variant that we see, you know, by fall, causing cases in unvaccinated people as well as vaccinated people. Obviously, there can be breakthroughs. But right now, people are kind of, I think, weighted with bated breath, you know, to see how bad this gets, to see what the rising cases looks like before making any sort of, you know, decisions about should we, you know, require people to wear masks again and indoors, should we once again implement, you know, social distancing requirements and things of that sort.
And we're talking a lot about the general public when it comes to vaccine rates, but Charlie, the state is having to, I guess the right word to be, incentivize some state employees to, especially frontline workers at, you know, veterans homes and other locations and work in prisons, to get vaccinated. Your thoughts on that? Because the governor this week also came out with, you know, more announcement of money and prizes for people that kind of get into another lottery in this for those frontline workers.
The difficulty is the frontline workers, people like prison guards and maybe people who work in nursing homes, they're not any different in a sense than the general public. There's a certain number of people out there who are, I guess, skeptics about the value of getting vaccinated. There are some people, hopefully a very small number, who think it's all a hoax, that it's all make-believe. There are others who, for whatever reason, because they're immunocompromised or maybe they have a religious objection, won't get vaccinated. But I think the people that the governor is trying to get to is folks who are kind of in the middle, sort of like, well, I don't have any real objections, but I don't want to bother getting vaccinated. And so that's, I think, what the prizes are about. We had a drawing the other day. The winners won't, their names won't be announced for another week or so, and not at all if they choose not to go public. But there was one vaccinated person in Chicago who won $1 million. And there were scholarships, I think, in Chicago and suburbs in DeKalb County, three students who got college scholarships in this drawing. And so everybody who's vaccinated in the general public is eligible to win one of these prizes. And the governor announced this week a new lottery for state workers who get vaccinated, where they can win money and prizes as well. So there's a lot of incentivizing doing. There was a story WBEZ did the other day, Becky Vivi and Matt Kiefer, that pointed out, we think that there's a disparity between the more urban areas in terms of vaccination and the more rural areas. Well, they looked at the vaccination rates in the Chicagoland area in the Cook County suburbs, and they found that the 10 communities with the highest vaccination rates were all majority white and affluent. The 10 communities with the lowest vaccination rates were majority black and low income. And the ones with the high vaccination rates, places like Northbrook, Des Plaines, Riverside, they were upwards of 70%. The lower ones, places like Dixmoor, Fort Heights, Riverdale, they were below 20%. They are all south suburbs, and the other ones are north suburbs or northwest suburbs. So it's not just downstate rural areas that we need to worry about. It's also those parts of the Chicagoland area. And as the study revealed, people who are low income, people of color. And part of the reason, one of the health officials was quoted in their story as saying, rates between Cook County suburbs can be attributed, among other things, to lack of transportation, fewer hospitals and clinics in the south suburbs, and a kind of a general distrust of the healthcare system among the Black community. So those are things that we have to work on. And the fear, of course, is that at some point we're going to get a virus that the vaccines don't work against, and then we're going to be in a world of trouble.
Some who can't get the vaccine are kids. And Hannah, of course, schools are talking about reopening again next month fully. Many of these schools are going to be ready to have these kids back in the classroom, and that's probably a good thing overall. I think most people would agree with that. However, there are probably a lot of concerns still, and do we know for sure if the state, I mean, I think there's still some guidance that's supposed to be coming from the state board to school districts. Do we know where that stands?
That's right. You know, as we are taping this on Friday morning, the CDC finally came out with guidance for schools for the fall. I mean, some districts go back in just a month, in pretty early August. And so a lot of school administrators had been getting antsy, waiting to hear from the State Board of Education, who in turn said that they were waiting to hear from the CDC and from the Department of Public Health, who was also relying on CDC's punting going on. But finally, the CDC has come out with guidance and said that vaccinated teachers and students do not have to wear masks. But, you know, for schools to strongly encourage students to get vaccinated, of course, if they can, if they're over aged, you know, 12 and over. But, you know, so this will be very interesting. It's, you know, unclear how schools will, you know, track who does and doesn't have a vaccine. And, you know, if Susie has to wear her mask because her mom didn't want her to get vaccinated, like, is Susie actually going to wear her mask in class when all of her best friends are not? You know, it's going to get tricky. It's going to get difficult. And then, you know, for those kids who are under 12, you know, that means that, so when you turn 12 and you get your vaccine, you can take your, while your 11-year-old classmates in, I guess that'd be the sixth grade, have to wear their masks. It's going to be just another tricky school year. You know, fortunately, hopefully not nearly as difficult as the last year in, you know, the back half, the 2019-2020 year. But my God, it's just, you know, again, this pandemic is not over. Obviously, we're having a pretty normal summer. Kids' sports have gotten pretty much back to normal, but we'll see. You know, that was a big fight, if you remember, in the fall and winter, especially boys' basketball, when, you know, the season started in November, or was supposed to start, rather. That's when we were getting hammered with the second wave of COVID. And, you know, we saw some lawsuits, and it was just really, really messy. It's yet to be seen what the State Board of Education will do with this new CDC guidance, but at least it's something, because those administrators, like I mentioned, pretty antsy because they only have a few weeks to plan for the next school year.
You're listening to State Week. I'm Sean Crawford, along with Hannah Meisel, Charlie Wheeler, and our guest today, Rachel Hinton of the Chicago Sun-Times. Well, President Joe Biden came to Illinois this past week and made a stop in the state. And what brought him here, Rachel? You covered him.
Yeah, he was here to promote his American Families Plan, the quote-unquote human infrastructure piece of his infrastructure bill, which largely deals with free community college, increasing Pell grants, expanding childcare access for working families, things of that sort. He was also here to talk about the infrastructure bill in general, which he's likely to face a fight, you know, in Congress. Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell said, you know, Republicans, Joe Biden and Democrats are in for a heck of a fight on this infrastructure bill, which they will try to pass in a Democrats only kind of way, called a reconciliation bill. Yeah, he was mostly here for that, and a lot of Democratic glad handing, you know, in the room in Crystal Lake at McHenry County College. Mostly to push that agenda, explain to Americans, Illinoisans, why this is important for the state and the nation.
Well, he met with the governor, but he also had, I guess, a brief meeting with Chicago's mayor. And of course, Chicago has been in the national spotlight because of the growing problem with violence there. Even the president has weighed in on that in recent weeks. Do we know if that was discussed by anyone during this visit to Illinois?
It definitely was brought up by Mayor Lori Lightfoot, who hours before, you know, President Biden's plane landed, three officers, two federal officers and one Chicago police officer, were shot on the southwest side. Mayor Lori Lightfoot allegedly, you know, brought that up, talked to the president about, you know, the need for federal resources, federal support. The White House press secretary said, you know, President Biden reiterated his commitment to helping the city, his commitment to addressing gun violence. Where that stands and whether or not the city is going to see more resources, more agents, more dollars, more funding, remains to be seen. I think that, you know, things are still being worked out, but we do know for sure that that was talked about, but the details, the finer details of that, we don't necessarily know.
And when I go back on this issue to when President Trump was in office, this had come up. He had talked at one point, I think, about sending military troops to Chicago. It doesn't appear as though we're to that level with the Biden administration, does it? I mean, or do we know what's going on there?
No, I would say that it's definitely a different situation under President Biden than President Trump. President Trump obviously would point to Chicago pretty regularly, point to the violence there, point to Chicago as, you know, a failed city led by, you know, a failed liberal. I don't think that we've gotten to that point, obviously, with President Biden. I think that, you know, given that they're of the same party, Mayor Lightfoot and President Biden, I think that there's going to be more of an opportunity to collaborate. But again, you know, we're still waiting to see what that collaboration looks like and what that will entail, you know, numbers wise.
Well, there was some more good financial news for the state this week. A credit upgrade. We talked about some of that last week, actually the last couple of weeks. We've been seeing some positive news. And also the fiscal year has come to an end, and the Commission on Government Forecasting and Accountability, which always puts together sort of a recap of tax revenue. And Charlie, they put out their report for the end of the fiscal year, and things do look pretty promising when it comes to what the state was able to bring in.
Yeah, the Commission on Government Forecasting and Accountability, the fiscal gurus for the General Assembly, pointed out that, not including the borrowing that we did, base receipts finished the year up they use the adjective, a stunning $6,792,000,000. There was some of that was federal money, but there was also the timing of income tax receipts related to last year's filing deadline and stronger underlying economic conditions. They pointed out net income tax receipts were up $5.5 billion. Now, some of that, roughly $1 billion of that, was attributed to the fact that the final filing deadline was pushed into FY21. But the sales taxes were up also more than $1 billion. And so that exceeded everybody's expectations. And in fact, that was one of the factors that led Standard & Poor to upgrade our bond rating. So that's good news.
Hannah, the governor was also busy signing some legislation this week. One of those bills that he took action on was a Medicaid expansion plan. So tell us what that does.
That's right. The governor this week signed, you know, kind of the latest in, you know, what lawmakers have tried to do for years to kind of maximize our federal Medicaid dollars. This particular law expands, especially mental health services. Medicaid for the first time would be able to cover, for example, marriage and family service, marriage and family therapists. It also gives help for folks who want to stop smoking, you know, for substance abuse. It requires that hospitals, you know, folks who come in with suffering from an opioid overdose, hospitals will be required to keep those folks overnight, you know, in order to treat them. Because a lot of times what happens is someone will come in and the hospitals, you know, might turn them away. And, you know, people who are suffering an overdose, their best chance of survival is to actually be in the hospital and receiving treatment for that. So it does a lot of things. And, you know, what I think is interesting is, unlike, you know, some of the healthcare focused bills that we've seen recently, you know, especially that the healthcare equity bill that was pushed by the Legislative Black Caucus earlier this year. This one received no opposition. It passed nearly unanimously this spring.
Well, let's save a couple of minutes here at the end to talk about politics and the election next year. We really still don't know what all is going to take place with the governor's race, but the race that seems to be getting a lot of attention is the Illinois Secretary of State's office. That race for that position has not really been open in about 20 years because we've had Jesse White in there, and he's been able to knock out any opposition during that time. But he says he's not going to run again. We're hearing a lot of different Democrats, even some Republicans, making their advances toward it. Rachel, you've been covering this. Where does it stand at this point? Do we have front runners already in this race?
Yeah, so we currently have four Democrats who've already declared their intention to seek the seat. I would say that of those four, Alexi Janulius seems to be the front runner for right now. I mean, obviously, you know, the primary is a little less than a year away, but he has pulled in the most money. He's pulled in some big labor endorsements, some other big endorsements as well from, you know, Congressman Chuy Garcia, you know, many labor councils, the SEIU, Illinois State Council has endorsed him. He seems to have the money advantage, the endorsement advantage. Obviously, money doesn't get you votes or doesn't equal votes, but it does help with that. Same with endorsements. So other than him, I would say Anna Valencia also seems to be doing well. City clerk, Chicago city clerk, Anna Valencia. She's at a money disadvantage compared to Janulius, who has currently, I believe, around $3 million on hand. But I mean, it's still anybody's race. There are no Republicans who have declared, you know, their intention to try to succeed Jesse White. But I believe Dan Brady in the House is looking at things. He's trying to figure out whether or not he wants to make a run for the office. Apparently, he commissioned a poll with Ogden and Fry earlier this week that showed Janulius in the lead. But currently, there's no Republicans in the race. They still have time to jump in. You know, currently it's a lot of sitting around and hurry up and wait, I guess, is what I would characterize it as. A lot of endorsements are coming out a lot earlier than we would typically see them, which is a little surprising for me. But yeah, I mean, we still have a primary that's a year off.
Yeah, Charlie, this has always been a prime office politically because, A, it controls a lot of jobs, and B, it's, you know, has always seemed to be a stepping stone to run for a higher office, including to run for governor. Your thoughts on basically the interest that's building up in that, and that interest has probably been tamped down for so long in that office because of Jesse White. Now there seems to be a lot of people who say, this is my opportunity.
Yeah, and in a way, there's interest among the political class and those of us who follow this, but I'm guessing the average Illinoisan probably knows who Jesse White is, has no clue who any of these other folks are, and probably hasn't given it an active thought in the last, well, since the last election when they voted for Jesse. So we're still pretty far away from the primary, which won't be for almost another year, not until June of 2022. And it's interesting to see whether, Rachel, you mentioned Valencia. If I'm not mistaken, she was endorsed the other day by Tammy Duckworth, who is going to be the first name you see on the ballot when you go to vote in November. And so how will that play? Janulius has the money. He's got the labor endorsements, but he's also got some baggage. So it's, as I say, it's a long way away, and I don't think anybody other than us is really paying attention to it yet.
Yeah, and just about 30 seconds here, Rachel, but that's the issue with a race like this, is getting people to pay attention, and I guess the sooner you start, the better.
I would totally agree. I think once you start pulling the endorsements, pulling the money, that allows for you to put out ads earlier. I mean, this is going to be a long campaign season, you know, given that this thing has now been moved further back. I don't think that that's going to stop, you know, the ads, the mailers, the politicking that we typically see. I think it's just going to mean that if you have the money, if you have, you know, especially as much money as Janulius seems to have, that means that you get to stay in the game a little bit longer, and you don't have to worry about, you know, oh, it's May and I don't have as much money as I'd like to be able to go up on TV or put out a digital ad. And also that allows for you to try to gain more voters, to try to reach more people. And the sooner you do that, the better. The more, you know, hands you shake, the more people who see your face and know what office you're running for. I think that only helps your case. I don't know that it necessarily hurts it. Although, you know, a longer primary season does mean that gives us, you know, in the media, slightly more time to start digging into people, start looking into backgrounds and see, you know, is someone saying one thing but doing another? Are they, you know, completely above board? Are they a little sketchy? So, I mean, it has its benefits and its drawbacks, but I would say for the most part, unless of course you're doing something a little shady, it's good, you know, to come out early and get all the support and money.
All right, it's time now for our notes from the field. And Rachel, let's start with you.
Yeah, so kind of segueing off the Secretary of State's race, D2s will be filed. The deadline is next week, July 15th. Some of the Secretary of State candidates have already started to hint that, oh, I've raised a lot of money, namely Janulius. It seems like he, this quarter, has raised nearly $900,000. Which would give him about $3 million on hand, as I said earlier. Along with him, I'll be looking into, you know, other elected officials, you know, former Speaker Michael Madigan, to see how much money he spent on legal fees, you know, the four tops, as we call them, Speaker Welch, Senate President Don Harmon, the Republican leaders, Jim Durkin and Dan McConkie, as well as, you know, Mayor Lightfoot. A poll came out a little bit ago showing that she is still, you know, public opinion still favors her. Many people still think she's doing a good job. I want to see if that is translated into money. So that's what I'll be looking out for.
All right, Hannah.
This week, I reported that the Illinois Policy Institute, a think tank that, you know, is known, definitely known in Springfield circles, but the listeners might have seen a post of theirs and not even known it, because they have developed such like an astonishingly good digital presence in the last few years, especially. Well, they are experimenting with campaign with candidate recruiting, rather, in tandem with a paper that they put out this week that details, you know, that Illinois' you know, political districts are uncompetitive. Not that that's something we didn't know. It'll be very interesting to see what comes of this program, if anything.
And Charlie.
Earlier, we were talking about how well the state has done with its traditional revenue sources, the income tax, both individual and corporate, and sales tax. But some of the taxes that we levy on sin also have shown improvement. For example, in the month of June, the recreational marijuana, hit $116 million in sales. And for the 6 months of 2021, we've generated $626 million in recreational cannabis sales, almost as much as we did in all of calendar year 2020. Not only pot, but the betting volume at Illinois sportsbooks hit $507 million in May. That was the second largest of any state in the U.S., just behind New Jersey.
All right, that's all the time we have for this episode of State Week. Our panel included Charlie Wheeler, Hannah Meisel, and also Rachel Hinton with the Chicago Sun-Times. You can get a podcast of our show. It's available at nprillinois.org, through the NPR One app, or at iTunes. And join us next time. I'm Sean Crawford.
You've been listening to State Week, a program of commentary and analysis of events in Illinois state politics and government. State Week is produced in the state capitol by public radio station NPR Illinois. This is IPR, Illinois Public Radio.